You know, honestly, I am working on my giant view because, you know, Sean told me he wanted a giant view from me. So I'm working on my giant view and for SeaWorld. So the interesting aspect of it is it will piss everybody off. What I have discovered about myself, I have an unparalleled ability to piss people off by writing something. I mean, I can piss people off by saying stuff, but not anything like the level that I can piss people off writing. I mean, if I send an email to somebody, I really want to smoke it. I will infuriate half the world. It's a unique ability. I don't know how God gave me that gift and I've not used it more.
This is like a whole, it's why we play like good cop, bad cop thing.
Are you trying to say that you're the good cop to my bad cop?
Obviously. Yeah. Emily's like, yes.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Well, I don't know how to take that. I've also got it. So beyond the giant view, I'm also working on another thing that I also forgot. Gee whiz, really packs me off. But I'm going to put it in here right now. I mean, this is a really big one for our restaurants. Emily, we opened up a new bar in Fayetteville called Tuskers Tavern, you know, to kind of honor the Razorbacks. Tuskers being, you know, a Razorback with big tusks. And of course, you know, one of the things about Tuskers Tavern and Arkansas Razorbacks is that Texas is now in the SEC, and I've hated Texas all my life, so now we get to play Texas again on a regular basis. Well, Tuskers acquired a trophy from Texas that most Texans don't know about, and it's the head of Bevo 14. Bevo 14 was the previous Texas mascot. And, you know, so we've got this huge longhorn head now in Tuskers Tavern that in order to honor Texas coming to the SEC, we've done what everybody outside of Texas that hates Texas is, turn Bevo's head upside down. So, you know, we can say down with the longhorns. So it's mounted on the wall, boom, and I've got to write the history of Bevo 14 and how we came to come up with Bevo 14. This will be another of the great opportunities that Todd has to put something in writing that will piss a bunch of people off. I'm telling you, it's true. A talent. Okay. So there we are.
It's a lot of information.
It is. And as Emily knows, I also have the ability to speak it as she and piss people off as she recently witnessed with the EPA. So, you know, it's a gift.
You have lots of special talents, Todd.
I do. I don't think any of them are about, you know, making you more money. But, you know, let's, I guess I should say, welcome to Stock Talk. Let's cue the intro.
Back. As y'all may can see in here, we have Emily Negrin from Inari with us. Emily, why don't you introduce yourself? Kind of tell us what your role is with Inari and all of that fun.
Yeah. So Emily Negrin, I am the Vice President of Corporate Affairs with Inari and have been with them for almost exactly 4 years at this point because I started the beginning of November of 2020, which was a wonderful time for all of us, really. But it was a great opportunity to start something new and, you know, join this company as it was starting to really advance its work. So for those of you who aren't familiar with Inari, we're the seed design company and really focused on bringing innovation to seed and a pure play technology company. So we're really 100% focused on how to unlock the full potential of seeds. And we're doing that through the use of AI-powered predictive design and multiplex gene editing. So in a nutshell, you know, we're using that AI-powered predictive design to understand as much as we possibly can about the genome of a plant and the different functions and how all the genes work together in order to determine how best to make the precise edit that is needed to drive the solutions that we're looking for. So you can kind of think of it as creating a blueprint that then we use with our multiplex gene editing toolbox to bring those enhancements to life through the plants. And we're focused on soybean and corn here in the US to get started. And we also have a project with a company out of Australia, Intergrain, to work on wheat. So my job in corporate affairs is to work on all of our communications efforts and then also oversee our government affairs work. So working very closely with a wide variety of associations to make sure that we're able to get this technology in the hands of farmers as efficiently as possible.
Yeah. And you feel like you're always jet setting, like you're all over the place all the time.
Yes. Yes. I, you know, I'm based full time in Minneapolis. So I'm a remote employee for the company. Our headquarters are in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And then we also have facilities in West Lafayette, Indiana, and Ghent, Belgium. So Cambridge and Ghent is where we do a lot of our early stage scientific research and development. And then West Lafayette, as you can imagine, has a lot more farmland available. So that's where we do product development and commercialization. So that's actually our largest and fastest growing facility at this point in time.
That's awesome.
And you guys got to come out recently and see the greenhouse expansion. So
yeah, that was fun. Really impressive.
Yeah, it's, you know, I started and they, you know, one of the first things we did, I think it was in 2021, we had a groundbreaking event kind of in that bubble when we thought COVID might be over. And the governor came and we had a great little open house reception to break ground on our phase one expansion. And by the time they opened phase one, we were breaking ground on phase two. So, I mean, that's just how quickly things have been moving and growing in Indiana. So it's been really fun to be a part of all of that.
So Emily, let's walk it back a little bit. So you've been at Inari for 4 years. Is that what you said? 4 years. Prior to that, let's take it back. You and I met all the way back. I know you're embarrassed to admit this, like when you were 12 years old in 2010.
Yeah. 12 sounds about right. Let's go with that.
And at that time you were working with an advertising agency, PR firm. And we got to meet there. And talk to me a little bit more about your career and how you got where you were, because I think it's been a little bit of an interesting path as you started out. And I mean, what's your background as far as agriculture interest, and how did you get into ag in the first place?
So ironically enough, I told my dad I would never work in agriculture because that was boring. So both of my parents grew up on farms, and by the time I was born, my dad's side of the family had retired from farming, but my mom's side of the family, my grandparents, were on the farm until we had to move them to a care facility at 93 and 97 years old. Wow. So yeah, they lived their whole life on the farm, and my dad, his whole career was with Monsanto. So I was very familiar with the ag industry and made the decision to go into public relations. And that's what I studied at the University of Minnesota. And like I said, initially had no interest in doing work in agriculture and started working with a lot of home good products, working with brands like Sherwin-Williams and Select Comfort. And then started doing a lot of stuff with food. I've worked with General Mills a handful of times and transitioned through a couple different public relations agencies here in Minneapolis and eventually ended up at Weber Shandwick. And I'd gotten hired there because they had a practice at the time called Food and Farm Advocacy. And they had a really great staff and a lot of people who actually grew up on farms and they knew the agriculture industry like the back of their hand. But what they were finding is a lot of the companies that were reaching out for help at that point in time were really looking at people that could help kind of bridge the gap between the agriculture community and, you know, more of that traditional consumer audience. But that had started to, that gap had gotten wide and it was creating problems. And at the time I was working at an agency that really specialized in the food service industry and had a lot of food experience. And through some networking conversations, they knew that I had a appreciation for the agriculture industry and an understanding of it because of my family background. And they kind of approached me and said, listen, we need somebody who can come in and help our clients understand how to better, you know, message to a more consumer audience that isn't coming in and trying to tell our clients what they're, you know, doing wrong or how they need to change their company to be more appealing to, you know, consumers. And I thought it was a really interesting challenge and, you know, took up the opportunity. And the irony is once I started working with agriculture clients, I had really no interest in doing anything else.
You had undue influence too. I mean, let's face it. You had the ability to say, this is what you should do and make people do it. That was the other thing that I noticed about you right off the bat.
Well, you know, I think I have, you know, for a variety of reasons, really honed a skill of understanding how to take some subject matters that can otherwise seem very, you know, complicated and overwhelming to people and figure out how to break them down into very, you know, digestible nuggets. And it was funny because, I mean, this is something I was
making this a whole thing. I'm talking about a freaking tie.
You're trying to get to the tie.
I'm talking about the tie. You're making this a whole thing about, you know, here's all the nuggets.
You asked her backstory and how she discovered influence.
Right. Better at Asta.
Well, you know what? Sometimes it's messaging and sometimes, you know, you meet people, Todd, and it just takes a little extra convincing or brute force.
It was an ugly freaking tie. Although I do have it.
You and still have it.
If I had been, that's right. If I had been really prepared for this stock talk, I would have brought it out and at least tied it on.
Yes.
So you would have recognized that thing, but clearly I wasn't that smart in prep. So the backstory is, I was at Syngenta 2010. Emily was working with Weber Shandwick. Somebody came up with the concept that everybody at Syngenta needed to wear the same tie. They decided that at Asta. So, you know, our ability to actually source an attractive tie was zero. So Emily and her team sourced ties. Now, they were uniform, so we could all look alike, but they were ugly. Ties were important to me at that stage in my life, which now I don't give a flip. But, you know, they were important to me at that stage. I had picked my ties carefully for Asta. I didn't want to wear an ugly tie. And so I was, you know, hard to deal with. I know that for our listeners, no one really believes that I could have been hard to deal with, but in that time.
Yeah, I think it took me handing probably a dozen ties to you before I finally, you know, got one that stayed in your possession.
Yeah.
But you were very kind and helped me, you know, make sure that I got the ties distributed to everybody else on the team.
Every single time Emily handed me a tie, I handed it to somebody else and just kept on going. And finally, I didn't have anybody to hand it to.
So, well, yeah. I found one of your customers and I really wish I would remember who this was because he was so helpful. And I asked him in front of Todd, I said, you know, I have a question for you. If I were to give you this tie and ask you to wear it to the party tomorrow night, would you do that for me? And he said, well, absolutely. And I go, so if I were to give this tie to Todd, he should wear it to the party tomorrow. And he looked at Todd and he said, absolutely. And I go, so if I give this tie to Todd right now and he's not wearing it at the party tomorrow, when you see him, will you be disappointed? And I think you even got a Mr. Martin at that point in time that you better wear that tie. And Todd just looked at me and smiled and said, well played.
I'm done. I have lost this battle. Hey, but you know, it's an important lesson. You do what you got to do to get the results that you need to get, right? Yeah. So there you go. Yeah. So after all of that, so you really kind of started out, you were at Weber Shandwick, and then you evolved and you took a trip through Winfield too.
Went to work for Winfield within their integrated communications team. And at the time, Lando Lakes owned a company called Geosys. For those of you familiar with the R7 tool, Geosys was the company that was really the technology behind that. And it was a company that was started in Toulouse, France, and you know, really one of the original companies in utilizing satellite imagery for agriculture. And it was a wonderful group of people. And in working with them, an opportunity came up to actually, you know, technically leave Land O'Lakes to go and work for Geosys. And I jumped on that. And it was a lot of fun learning about a completely different side of agriculture, because it was getting a lot more into the technology side. And today they're Earth Daily Agro and doing some exciting work, and it's always fun to see what they're up to. But I actually always had an interest in genetics. At one point in high school, I even thought about going more into that biological study, but decided I didn't have the patience for lab work. And you know, went more into the communication side of things. And you know, was seeing all these things happening with CRISPR, and it was something that always sparked my interest. And I'd actually read a story about Inari pretty early on. And Ponzi Trivisvamet is our CEO, and I had Syngenta as a client, but not when she was there, but had been introduced to her along the lines and, you know, was very impressed by her. And when I saw that she was there and leading this company, it just, like I said, it really sparked my interest. And then a recruiter ended up getting in contact with me about an opportunity to go work for this company, Inari. And, you know, one of the benefits of COVID was everybody was working remote. So I could stay in Minnesota and do this work. And it was, you know, decided to take a chance. I'd never done anything with a startup before. I've probably never worked harder in my career, but I can honestly say that I don't know that I've ever enjoyed my work as much either. Like it's just been really interesting work and, you know, some exciting challenges to figure out. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm not one who's been known for, you know, being able to sit still for too long. So it keeps me on my toes and gives me a lot of things to stay really engaged with. So I've enjoyed it a lot.
Okay. So I'm going to ask a question that really Catherine should be asking, but I mean, so I've known you for a long time, Emily, and know that you've got two sons and you've been doing the jet setting life for a while. Because with Geosys, I knew that, you know, they were over, you know, located in France. And so you were back and forth over there a lot. You've had a lot of travel. Clearly, you're a successful woman in the business, but you do a lot of travel. How are you balancing all this stuff from a family perspective?
You know, I am very fortunate to have a husband who is very much all in on the parenting activities. You know, it is definitely a 50-50 workload split in this household. And, you know, especially, you know, when the kids were younger and I had a lot of travel, we're lucky my parents are about 2.5 hours away and both have remote jobs at this point. So it's been easy for them to come in and help out when I've had some of the longer trips and give him some extra support when needed. Now that the kids are a little bit older and slightly more self-sufficient, it eases that workload a little bit. But you know, it it takes a village, and I'm very appreciative of the village I have that allows me to do this work.
So, I mean, it definitely takes a village, 100%. You know, we've got three kids in our house and, you know, job, and, you know, my husband has a job and too many dogs to count. I mean, literally six dogs. And so it does take a massive village.
That's an elective. Hey, that's an elective problem.
It is an elective. I understand. But I mean, I find myself, like, you know, number one, when I travel, which is not near as much as you do, sometimes I have the whole mom guilt thing, you know, or I'm trying to get stuff done and the kids have activities. And so I'm having to postpone stuff. And there's nights where I work at, you know, until 2 a.m. just because I haven't been able to do it during the day. So how do you deal with the stress of all of that? Because I find myself getting overwhelmed sometimes and just being basically a stress ball. And probably nobody wants to be around me. But how do you deal with that?
A couple of things. I, you know, and this is going to sound really cheesy, but and I think this was, I mean, it was probably early on when I had became a mom. I used to be a fan of Grey's Anatomy. Mm-hmm. And there was this scene that always stuck with me where I think this was like the point where Meredith was had become a single mom, for those who watched the show. So she was one of the main doctors and her husband dies and she has kids, and something came up and she needed to get back to the hospital, and she was dropping off her children with one of the other doctors to take care of them so she could go back to the hospital. And she was having this moment of total mom guilt of, you know, I've been gone from my kids from a lot, now I'm, you know, going to be gone from them again. And this is, you know, I should be with them more. And the other doctor said, you know, you are showing your kids that, you know, women have a role in the world and you're contributing something really important, and they're going to see that and they're going to remember that, and don't feel bad about doing the work that you do. And, you know, I'm not claiming that I'm a doctor out there saving lives. but, you know, I do believe, and I think this was a big part of, you know, my excitement around Inari. And, you know, quite frankly, this is the longest I've ever been in a job.
What does that say?
Yeah, but I think part of it is, you know, I get stir crazy, or, you know, there was just some places I worked that just were not the right fit for me.
Right.
But I think another big thing for me is, you know, finding that sweet spot of, you know, what is it that you're really good at? And what are you really passionate about?
Yeah.
And I have always been very passionate about issues related to global hunger. And this is something that, you know, I realized not the probably level of it at a young age, but I realized at a young age that I had been taken for granted my access to good quality meals. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's something that stuck with me, and I've always just had this desire to do something to help other people and to make sure that, you know, there should be no reason that there's not enough food for everybody in the world.
Right.
Like, everybody, you know, should be able to eat. My son asked me once, if I had one wish, what would I do? And I said, I would make sure that no one ever went hungry again. And he asked me why. And I said, you know, because I think it actually would solve so many other problems. I don't think people realize like how much national security issues come into food. And when you look at the places where there's a lot of instability, a lot of it is around the fact that people don't have access to nutritious, affordable food. Because, I mean, think of how crazy we all got during COVID when, you know, that our shelves weren't as, you know, amply stocked as we were used to. You know, if we were in a state where we weren't sure how we were going to feed our children for the next couple of weeks, we would all start probably making some really poor decisions about what we were willing to do to make sure that our kids didn't go hungry. Yeah. And
that's kind of interesting because I got to tell you, during the early months of COVID, beyond trying to find toilet paper everywhere, because let's face it, the important yeah. thing was toilet paper. Yeah. It was not, what are you going to eat? We did build a greenhouse thinking, oh, this is going to be great. We're going to raise our own food and we're going to make sure we have enough to eat. So we have a greenhouse. Yeah, it has not turned into a vegetable greenhouse. It has every plant that my wife ever thought about wanting to have. She's turned into the plant lady.
So, yeah.
But that is one of the things that we did from that perspective.
So to kind of touch back on what you said, how you have a passion for, you know, making sure nobody goes hungry. Do you feel like that's a driving force at Inari for y'all?
Absolutely. I mean, and it's something that you'll hear a lot of people, you know, speak to, and Ponzi has an incredible story. When she actually first started, you know, doing work in agriculture, she had an opportunity, and there was a farmer who, because of the seed technology that he was going to be able to use for the first time, would be able to afford meat for his family. And he was 70 years old.
Wow.
And, you know, and that was kind of her aha moment of like, this is a real problem that, you know, that has a solution. Yeah. that, you know, we can address this, we can work on this. And, you know, and there's lots of other stories of people at Inari. And I think, you know, we talk a lot about our sustainability platform and the fact that it is a three-legged stool. And, you know, the important thing about a three-legged stool is they have both, all three legs have to be equal. Otherwise the stool isn't functioning. And, you know, a big part of that obviously is, you know, taking care of the planet, but equally important is making sure that we can produce enough food to make sure that the global population, you know, can eat. And the other leg of that stool is making sure that the farmers who take on this incredible responsibility of growing food for a global population are, you know, have profitable businesses. You know, they need to be able to care for their family and their community in a meaningful way. We can't ask them to sacrifice everything just so the rest of us can eat and live comfortable lives. Right. So, you know, I believe very strongly in those, you know, three pillars. And, you know, without question, the work that's being done at Inari with gene editing and, you know, really enhancing the capacity of the seed itself to be able to do more or better, has so much potential. And, you know, what drives me crazy is when you run into roadblocks of getting it out there. And it's like, this is
exactly what I was about to ask. Like, what
this is silly.
What is the biggest, you know, roadblock or, you know, speed bump that you see down the road to make sure that this all becomes to fruition?
Well, let's play with that a little bit, because, you know, we talked about the EPA at the top of the, broadcast. Let's hone in on that a little bit. I mean, it's been about 5 weeks ago that we sat down with EPA. You were there along with IPSA. And, you know, I think there were some things that came out that the EPA didn't like to hear. You're welcome. you know, but one of the challenges that we've had, and I think we've tried to give voice to this now for four solid years, is the fact that we believe in technology. We believe in intellectual property protection. We believe in the patent system. But there's a complex array, especially in the corn and soybean and cotton seed markets, that have this conjunction of plant variety protection patents coming out of the genetics and then biotech patents coming out of the technology side that coalesce into one unit where you get double protection and that stacked protection at different times arbitrarily extends and is used to extend patent lives well beyond the 20 years established with patents. I totally respect that in the biotechnology space, because of the difficulty in getting registration, you know, registering a patent and getting that technology protected, it's somewhat of a game. What's the best time to do it, knowing that it's going to take years out on registrations in order to bring stuff forward? But nonetheless, we're sitting here and it's 2024. The first BT products hit the market in 1995, 96. We're almost 30 years in. We have not yet seen a significant impact of a post-patented product. And, you know, I think every day, and every person that is listening to this can relate to the fact that generic drugs, post-patented drugs, have been a blessing to Americans to reduce their overall medical cost.
Absolutely. And yet,
we have not been able to see that same type of reduction in cost to farmers. And famously, I'll get off this in a minute, famously, NK603, which is Roundup Ready corn, Roundup Ready 2 corn, as a matter of fact, is off patent. And yet I know that royalties on Roundup Ready corn are in excess of $100 a bag. And that is a price that's continuing to increase. And that's a price that seed companies pay and hence farmers pay. So, you know, now Roundup Ready is not judged by the EPA, but there are instances where the EPA, with their insect resistance management program, seem to be standing in the way and hindering the introduction of post-patent traits. So that was one of the messages I think we got out. Emily, can you build on that a little bit more and talk about, you know, how to help move that forward?
Yeah, I mean, there's a complex web, and you know what we have talked a lot with, especially, you know, policymakers and lawmakers in DC, and you know, Todd, you brought up generic drugs, is, you know, this the same problem ultimately happened with the drug market, where there were no generic drugs coming out, and it, you know, caused people to, you know, start asking questions and wonder, okay, so you have all these drugs that are off patent, where's the generic market? And the issue was, you know, you have to make submissions to, for drugs to the FDA, and you have to have so many years of clinical trials run in order to get your clearance. Well, because of the way the system is set up, no one could run their trials until the patents expired. So the patents would expire, and then that's when people could start doing research. So then it would take another 5, 10, 15, 20 years before you know, these companies would have their data set for the generic equivalent to get its approval. So there was a law passed that said, you know, this was never the intent of how we wanted this to work. So, you know, we will allow companies, you know, to start doing their research for their generic versions while still under patent. They just can't bring it to market until the patent is up. And, it, you know, I'm sure the drug companies didn't love this, but I don't think any of us feel like the major drug companies have, you know, disappeared because the generic market exists. They all seem to be doing just fine. So, you know, we're now in a similar place with GM traits on seeds. We're not seeing a market for generic GM traits. And, you know, there's some that like to make the argument, well, there's not a desire because companies keep coming out with better things. So there's no desire to have this generic version because we've already, you know, the technology has moved beyond that. Maybe, but if there's also nothing available, how do you know that nobody wants it? And well, and why not give anybody the opportunity to at least bring it forward and create those opportunities. And, you know, that, so we're in the same problem with GM traits. And because of all the layers of patenting, you know, you have to have a certain amount of research, especially if it's for an insect resistant trait such as BT, and you have to go through the EPA, you need a certain amount of research. All your research has to be done within the United States. Right now, it's not legal to do all that research in the United States on a patented product until the patent is expired.
So here's a point. So when we look at a generic drug or a generic chemical, okay, the active ingredient, I get it, is the same. It might have different inerts. It might be formulated differently, but you know, the AI is supposed to be somewhat identical to, you know, the off patented product. Mm-hmm. When we're talking about a biotech trait, we're not talking about anything other than the absolute identical piece. It is the same event, the same 100% through and through. So knowing that, and I'll use an old product from my history, BT11, you know, discovered by Sandoz years ago and still in the Syngenta lineup, a great stacked BT trait, great on European corn borer. But if you look at BT11, branded BT11, if you will, from Syngenta, versus a generic BT11 or a post-patent BT11 from someone else, is identical. It is still BT11. It is not formulated differently. It's not mixed differently. It's BT11. So why can we not convince the EPA that this data exists? If there's data, you know, compensation rules that exist in generic chemistry, that if I want to introduce a generic chemical that somebody has, I have to, in order to quote their data, I have to, you know, pay them data compensation. And then by law, I can get that. Why do we not have that same thing? It's ridiculous to assume that.
So technically it exists. The challenge is the owner of the data gets to set the price for it. So they can, you know, with your BT11, Syngenta could put any price tag they want to be able to access.
And we're not pointing that Syngenta's done.
No.
That is an example.
Right. Yeah. So, you know, there's, this is a little out of my area of expertise. I'm not a regulatory person. But you know, there's the way data works with the EPA. There's a set amount of time where it's considered proprietary. Nobody can access it. And then there's a set amount of time where it's, you know, kind of available for purchase, if you will. And then there's a set amount of time where it's considered old and it's considered public domain. There's a bit of a game that can be played because you can, as a registrant, you can say, oh, look it, I have new data and new information. So this is the latest version. So now you restart the clock.
Yeah. So what we need to have happen, it sounds like, is a clarification on the law that once the patent expires, that data is in the public domain. And then, rock and roll. I mean, I look at it right now and again, soybeans kind of out because we've got a lot happening in the herbicide market with soybeans. But when we look at corn and and insect resistance, I want to say in 2027, some 60% of the corn market, of the current insect resistant corn market across the board, will be off patent. I mean, that's going to include, you know, at least 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 different trait stacks that I know. Now, granted, there are some new pieces that are coming in. There's RNAi technology that Bayer has introduced that is new on rootworm. So there is that. But otherwise, there's an enormous amount of the market that should be subject to seeing dramatic price reductions and new competition, which will do nothing but help farmers and help independent seed companies, giving them further choices. how do we bring that market to fruition, given some of the limitations that we have? I mean, I guess, Emily, what I'm asking you is what needs to happen at the government level in order to make this stuff happen?
You know, one of the things that we've been really impressed with is the seed liaison office that USDA started. So the meeting you referenced before were EPA. It was a joint meeting between EPA and USDA. And, you know, we've been really pleased with the work that's been coming out of the seed liaison office within the USDA. And one of the things we've been pushing really hard for in conversations on the Hill is to ensure that there's continuous funding as part of the Farm Bill so that that office remains intact and can continue to do their work. Because they're looking into a lot of these issues and, you know, where, you know, I'm going to give the EPA and the government the benefit of the doubt and say that no one created all of these, you know, rules and regulations with the intent of blocking competition in the marketplace. It's just, it happened. And now they need to, you know, figure out where those roadblocks are and start cleaning them up. And I think that, you know, the seed liaison office is doing a lot of work to really, you know, dig deep into some of these things and understand how systems work. And we've heard from people like, well, if this is such a problem, why aren't more people talking about it? And I think it's because it's so complex, because it gets into all these different layers of IP law, which, you know, most of us don't really understand. There's even a lot of lawyers who don't, you know, understand all the complexities that, that get into IP law, unless that's their area of expertise.
Well, so you have these... and to that point, I mean, really and truly, we're looking at the situation that because you've got, again, this, you know, coalition of genetics and biotechnology traits under two different patent regimens and two different intellectual property pieces that are sold as one unit. I mean, yeah. I have worked diligently to be able to compare our industry to another. And quite frankly, I can't find one. Even on the technology space, I can find issues around, you know, bundling and packaging, but none of them relate into this whole biological framework and the power that's out there. I do have to say this. I think there has been a incredible effort and a, you know, an incredibly strong effort that some of the companies have undergone with growers specifically to convince growers that, you know, a generic biotech product is inferior to the current biotech product. And, you know, I say that with the realism of understanding that being an old guy and back in the old days, you know, you still bought Tylenol when generic acetaminophen came onto the market because Tylenol was better.
I like, you know, the coating on my Advil.
I have to admit, I still buy Tylenol and drives my wife crazy because she's like, what are you thinking? I want Tylenol.
I want generic.
I don't want Ivy. Okay.
I buy
plenty of, I buy plenty of generic drugs that we will not discuss on this podcast. But when it comes to Tylenol and ibuprofen, I get Tylenol.
But I think the, you know, the argument for that was one thing when commodity prices were beautiful.
Yeah.
I think, you know, the dynamics have shifted and, you know, farmers are, they're being, you know, pinched for every penny that they have between, you know, the seed and the inputs and, you know, if they're renting land, I mean, there's equipment and they're in a very different position today. Mm-hmm. And there's not, you know, when you sit in, you know, I had the opportunity to join the American Soybean Association. They had their state association meeting earlier this week in St. Louis, and, you know, listening to an update from their economist, you know, it's going to continue to be tight for a while. I think that's where, you know, it's really unfortunate that there aren't more options available. Cause yeah, maybe you are somebody who, you know, wants to still buy the name brand stuff and that works for you. And, you know, you have a great relationship with, you know, your dealer, retailer, or whoever it is, where that makes sense for your operation. But there are some farmers that it might not. And, you know, and maybe the ROI just isn't there, but when they have no other options, what are they supposed to do? Well, you know, and
exactly. I mean, it's about options and opportunities and the ability to make a choice. Yeah. I mean, and we do have choices out there, but to this specific thing, you know, farmers are going to, you know, you've got farmers that are going to sit out there and they're going to focus on yield. You've got farmers that are going to focus on return. You've got people that are going to, you know, buy branded. They're going to have great relations with a local rep. They're going to trust that person because he or she is their trusted advisor. Yep. I mean, you've got all of these different aspects, but it is about giving people the choice to make that decision, you know, rather than having an arbitrary system that denies them that ability.
Yeah. Well, and so then you look at this and say, okay, so Emily, you've been talking about the fact that Inari is doing this exciting, you know, new form of breeding with gene editing. Why are you guys getting so whipped up about these issues? And, you know, I talk to people a lot. The exciting thing with what we can do with gene editing is truly about enhancing the potential of the seed itself. What GM traits have been incredibly powerful is protecting the potential of the seed. So as we, you know, our focus with our, you know, first generations of products really is on enhancing the yield potential. Well, if we're going to enhance the yield potential, we still want to protect it with all the technology that's available. So, you know, and when you look at the fact that the soybean and corn market, 90% of the acres in the United States carry GM traits, it's become table stakes here. So, you know, we knew that there's going to have to be options for farmers to have these traits. They needed ways to protect their field still. And, you know, the licensing fees, as your members know better than anybody, get pretty hefty. And that's where we started really looking into what are the opportunities for generic traits. You know, can we package this up in a different way to, you know, manage the price of it in a meaningful way for our customers and their customers? And that's when we started really understanding all of the complexities that are involved and, you know, why there isn't a robust market today.
And it's interesting. All this happens to be coalescing too at the exact same time, you know, post-patent traits are, you know, at least patents are going to expire off so many post-patent or so many insect corn traits at a time when farmers need it because commodity prices are low, seed companies, independent seed companies need it to help their own returns for their investments. But if we look at the multinationals, I mean, we went through a segment a few months ago where weekly there was a major story about, you know, financial issues at Bayer, financial issues at Syngenta, financial issues at Corteva. Nobody in the farming sector is doing real well right now. And, you know, so there's pressure at all levels. So I get that the multinationals that, you know, own the patents need to protect what the revenue they've got going in. Get that 100%. I just happen to be on the side of the independent seed companies and the farmers saying that I understand where you're at, but, you know, this has got to happen. It's going to happen.
And for our whole conversation about, you know, the pharmaceutical world, the brand drugs are still out there. They're still available. Those companies are still, you know, running healthy businesses. This idea that a generic market is going to, you know, destroy the value of the name brand offerings, it just doesn't hold any water. And, you know, one of the things that I've learned to really appreciate about the intent of our patent system here in the United States is that it was, you know, it's actually in our Constitution. It's not even an amendment. It is in our Constitution. This is something that we believe in is really important as a country, is driving innovation. And the idea behind the patent system is to really encourage, you know, people, companies to innovate and discover and bring things forward, and you would get protection for it. And that's where a lot of people's understanding of patents seem to stop, is the idea of like, well, you know, I created this thing, I get to protect it, and it's mine, and it's proprietary. Yes, and there was always intended to be a limit on that. And the limit was to help drive further innovation. So a key component of anybody in any industry getting a patent is describing the discovery or invention in a way that anybody with reasonable knowledge could replicate it. Obviously, with seeds, that gets a little bit more complicated because nobody can actually replicate a seed. So in those circumstances, when you're talking about a biological product, you have to make a deposit. You have to supply the seed so that anybody can look at it and understand what you've done. But the whole purpose is so that someone can take that and learn from it and say, okay, I see what you did, and now I'm going to figure out how to make it better. And then I'm going to get a patent on my thing because I made it better. And then someone's going to learn from that and make it better. And that was the idea behind how we continue as a country to drive innovation and keep things moving forward. It was sharing the knowledge. You get to protect it for a set period of time, but you share that knowledge so that others can take that knowledge in its entirety and learn from it and build on it. And, you know, there's nothing stopping from you from building on your own and continuing to grow with it. But if you want the government to give you that protection for that period of time, you have to share the knowledge. And it was to drive that further innovation. And I think that's something that's really gotten lost in a lot of conversations that I see today, is everyone gets so hung up on the protection aspect of the U.S. patent system. And yes, that is important. I mean, and especially as Inari is a small company, we find a great deal of value in being able to protect what we're doing, because we know there are bigger players who have more money than us, that if we couldn't protect what we were doing, they'd be able to pick it up and run with it, you know, rather quickly. But we also appreciate that the exchange of that protection is sharing your knowledge and helping other people build and grow from it. And, you know, when I think about the challenges that we face as a global community, and, you know, we talked about the hunger issues and, you know, whether or not you believe in climate change, we can all accept that the challenges of growing plants today has become different. We are having extreme weather events annually. You know, one year an area will have a drought and the next year they'll have flooding. You know, we need solutions that are more adaptable to these extreme weather events in order to help farmers continue to be able to grow things. And there's no one company that's going to solve all of these problems. There's not two companies that are going to solve all these problems. We need lots of people, you know, in the mix, thinking about how we address all these challenges and bringing solutions forward. And we should encourage that. And I think that's, to me, is where I start to get really frustrated, is this idea that, you know, there should be fewer people working on this. Like, no, everyone should be working on this.
Innovation comes about when a lot of people are out there trying to solve a problem and make some real things happen. So, you know, I agree with you. I mean, we've got to move the peg substantially in this area in order to address all these issues. And I mean, I think that one thing that I'm continued to believe is that we've got to convince, you know, those of us that are able to at this juncture hold our government regulations, and the EPA being one of them, is that, yeah, something important to them, like insect resistant management, is important to us all for durability of our technology. But that doesn't mean that there cannot be a robust post-patented product, far more choices. We've just got to find the clear path to be able to solve both of those. And you can't make those decisions in a pure environment like I think the EPA tries to do too many times. Yeah. So, you know, we've got a lot of challenges, but it is about innovation. It's about companies that are standing up to work on innovation. And, you know, a little bit, maybe it does take a village more than just yes. children, but to actually get where we need to go in our next innovation.
Yeah. And, you know, there's definitely been some points of frustration, but I know, you know, our regulatory team has also been, you know, working very closely with the EPA on a few things, and hopefully, you know, we'll have some more to share on that front. But, you know, I do want to give credit where credit is due. And, you know, it's the system is far from perfect, but they've been willing to come to the table and have discussions with us and, you know, listen to where we pointed out, okay, you know, here's a challenge, or allowed us to bring ideas to the table of like how we might approach something differently. But I want to, you know, I think we've been successful in doing that because we have, you know, a robust regulatory team. We have, you know, a really incredible legal team. You know, we have lots of people who understand all these things and how it all works, who are able to work very closely together to bring solutions forward. And I realize that's probably not true for other companies that are just trying to get started in this space.
I will
say, we're fortunate.
I will say that one thing that I would really like to do, and I'm starting to see signs of that, but we'll see how it goes. I mean, look, it's going to be an important topic one way or another. Transparency in government for me at this juncture is the thing that will help us as groups make decisions.
Yep.
And I'm going to talk more about that, but I mean, if I could circle the problem with that I have with EPA right now in this area is transparency. There are too many things that happen behind the curtain. So, yeah. You know, I think that that's a battle that we've yet to fight, and we have to fight more. And yeah, they like the way that it is currently. And they would disagree when I say that, but I think we all know where that is.
I also, you know, one of the things that I have come to appreciate in the, you know, past two-ish years of me diving more into government affairs and learning more about our regulatory space is how frequently the EPA and USDA gets sued by activist NGO organizations. And it's really frustrating to me that so much good work is, you know, held in limbo because, you know, our government agencies don't want to deal with another lawsuit from some NGO because they don't like science. And, you know, it's kind of mind-boggling to me how much probably all of our taxpayer dollars are wasted fighting over scientific facts because somebody doesn't like science.
Yeah.
Everyone should be able to choose solutions that are best for them, but in choosing the solutions that are best for you, it shouldn't mean that you get to decide that your solutions are also what everybody else should be taking. You know, I regularly eat products that contain GM ingredients, but, you know, I think it's, you know, I have no problem with people who, you know, make other choices for whatever reason that they want to make them. But it doesn't mean that I shouldn't be able to choose what I want to buy at the grocery store.
Yeah.
And I don't think it means that farmers should be forced to choose, you know, one, you know, type of seed or one method of producing their crops because someone feels that it is superior. And that's what I think bogs are systemed down a lot more than some people realize, is the layers of lawsuits that come up from NGOs just getting mad about the way the world works.
And we're not going to talk about NGOs this session. We'll come back.
We don't have time for that.
Emily, thanks for the time today. We really appreciate you joining us on Stock Talk. It's interesting. I know y'all got a lot of good, cool stuff going on at Inari, and look forward to seeing you at the IPSA annual conference in ASTA here in a few weeks.
Yeah. And we are really looking forward, especially to joining you all out in Palm Springs in January. And I'll, hopefully your members are making time to join us the last day, and we'll be sharing more about the work and kind of the exciting things that are coming up in 2025.
Awesome.
Sounds great.
Awesome. Well, all right, Emily.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks, everybody. And be sure and
subscribe, and share.
There we go.
Yeah, subscribe, and share this podcast so we can get the word out and get some more people into our audience. But until next time.
Thanks, everybody.